So Shad's question was, why do you think that great sex would correlate with increased pain at the end of a relationship? What do you think?
Miss that greater loss.
More grasping. Well, what? And I guess we'd have to look at what is the nature of the pain at the end of the relationship. We'd have to kind of analyze what that suffering was like when the relationship was over, and that suffering would be, I think, a lot of grasping, grief, sadness that it's over. What else?
Probably, if the sex was, really out of this world, then probably in your giving, you're in the act or that moment, more of your own self, you're giving that to them. You're giving it.
Yeah.
It's a great deal that you're giving there.
Yeah, you're exposing yourself, opening yourself up. Yeah.
Physical withdrawal.
Physical withrawal. Yeah, there's a physical, right, withdrawal of the intimacy.
Fear of never having that great sex again.
Yeah, and I think it's a realistic fear, because if you had an incredibly good sexual relationship, it's very possible you may never have that again. Totally possible. I'd say even likely, right? So the fears are very, very valid.
I'm not sure that
that's really
that your premise is true.
Yeah, alright, good. Yeah, which one?
the pain at the end of the relationship is greater because of the sex. I think it's maybe greater because of the depth of love you had for the person.
Yeah, I think you can.
Well, I was going to say.
Which doesn't have. I mean, there's a physical part of it, but there's a whole lot of love that's beyond the physical.
No, yeah, and I think for everybody, like, people will respond to different things, but I think that. The premise would still be the same, meaning that the greater the level of fill in the blank, right? The greater the level of suffering when that fill in the blank is over.
Well, right? Let's not forget that you preceded this by saying that this is one of the two events which make you feel completely innocent and compassionate, loving and all that stuff. So it's not really sex, it's the opening of those chakras which you lose from.
Yeah, which is another interesting point, which I hope we'll have time to come back to. All right, so I want to try to stay on a thread. All right, so we're back to Brooke's thing, right? Which I rephrased as, okay, if it's possible, and fill in the blank for whatever it is for you, but great sex correlates with the intensity of pain at the end of the relationship. For a thinking wise person...
Okay.
Hold on one sec.
Hypothetically,
yeah. For a thinking wise person, again, fill in the blank, just change it out. Wouldn't then you want to not have great sex because you wouldn't want to experience the intensity of the pain? And Brooke, this is a little bit what you're getting at. How can you be completely passionate? How can you be completely engaged in the world, right? Without falling into this constant pull and pull of aversion and attraction? Because in a sense, what we see as pleasure, or what we see as a kind of robust joy, like pleasure, joyfulness, happiness, has to do with this movement. Like with this, like, passionate, Zorba the Greek, like, full passionate thing. So the question is it possible to live a robust, passionate life that doesn't revolve around this constant movement?
Is that the goal?
Well, because what would the middle path look like? It would mean, and here's why I brought up the whole thing of the difference between young and old monks, is for young monks, that's like, I'm on the middle path.
Right.
I'm subdued, I'm not attached to the pleasurable experience, I'm not attached to the unpleasurable experience, right? And I don't think that's it. There's something else, but we're not there yet, you see what I'm saying? Any thoughts, any ideas, any problems at this point? Yeah. Oh, yeah, let me go to you first.
Well, I was just thinking the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Now, maybe it wasn't the best sexual relationship you ever had. It fell apart.
Yeah.
The relationship fell apart and you sensed failure.
Yeah.
In addition to all the other emotions.
Yeah.
So, it doesn't have to be that it was the greatest. It was another time that you felt you failed.
Yeah. And I think the example is flawed only in that it's, that might be an example that resonates for me. But like I just had, I honestly can say I had the best chai latte of my life the other day. And I got a small one. And it was unbelievable. A nice foam top, a little bit of cinnamon that actually like coagulated to make it a little bit of like, a, you could crunch on a little bit. It time market. And they paid me to say that. I guess for doing so. No, but it was so good. And when it was over, it was just like, ugh. You know, again, as if it was like a mediocre, if it was a mediocre chai, it would just be like, yeah, whatever, enjoy the cup with me. But it was so good. I'm like, and you know, I'm in the back of work, like sucking, I'm just waiting for the foam to fall. You know, so I got the cup like this. And my workmates come in, they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm waiting. You know, because I want every like drop of the foam, you know. And so the example's flawed, I think only in that the different examples will work for different people. But what I mean to say is the intensity of pleasure correlates to the intensity of the grief when that pleasure is over.
Did you feel you had to go back as soon as possible and have another latte?
If I could have, I would have bought another. Until I started feeling satiated, right? It's like we're in constant search of this like moment of satiation, which is a false search because it never comes. It comes for a split second, like eating, right? We're trying to fill our bellies, we're trying to get satiated, and then we'll either make it and we'll be there for a little bit of time, and then something else will come in, some other dissatisfaction, or we'll eat too much. Right? And then we'll feel like, oh, God, I feel horrible now. Or we'll eat and then we'll get tired. You know, all of these ways that we're looking for that point of satiation. But hold on, Shad, what were you going to say earlier? Do you remember?
Well, I want to preface this by saying I don't know. But perhaps, you know, with the realization that all relationships ultimately end,
yeah,
then we can allow ourselves to be in the moment and be passionate in the moment.
Yeah.
Be present with someone. Enjoy the experience in the moment without holding on to the, oh my God, what if they leave, or they get in that car, or whatever.
Yeah, and
I'm not saying that I am able or capable.
No,
of
no.
Just that,
yeah.
That's the, but, you know.
Yeah.
Potential.
I think, the risk of being wrong. I think no relationship ends. All relationships change, and I think that. When I sense, and I want to believe that when I'm in the physical body, I am conditioned by choking my true nature, which is in this release and expansion.
Yeah.
And looking for these openings is the sole purpose of living. And so if we don't have the understanding that relationships just change and we can move on and go seek for this in another place, then we generate suffering. Because we close ourselves to a continuous change of things, and that finding this release is always at the next corner if we have that wisdom.
Yeah, we're slowly getting into it, and we're starting to talk more about the wisdom and the wisdom gap and infusing that.
So thinking about the difference between an experiential happiness and a sense happiness.
Yeah.
So when you were with the goat,
yeah,
that was a situation that no matter how hard you tried, you knew you could not reproduce that. You knew that level of happiness would not return.
Yeah.
Even if you had a friend go plant a goat in the mud, it's not going to happen.
Right.
You're drinking that chai latte.
Yeah.
There's a part of you that is having the sensual pleasure of drinking the chai latte. And I'm willing to bet there was part of you saying, I can't wait to take so-and-so there. I can't wait to have another one of these. Ooh, I can get one of these on Friday. Every Friday. This could be my treat.
Yeah.
And it's taking away from the sense of pleasure because you're taking the experiential pleasure out of it. Like, right now, it's something about it, this right time, right place, it's just hitting me right now. And instead focusing on how can I reproduce this?
Mm-hmm.
How can I get this again? I can get this again. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
And getting hooked on that.
The goat story is it keeps on giving.
Yeah. Yeah. It even keeps on giving now, about
right.
5 years later.
Yeah, because anytime you think of that experience, you're like, wow, I'm so glad you saved that goat. You know? You're not like, oh, when can I save a goat again?
Yeah. No, I mean, you guys are both onto it. And maybe that's a tool we can have when judging what's actually giving us pleasure. Mm-hmm. Is it the gift that keeps on giving? Let's take a quick, Brooke, can you hold on to your thought for a sec? Let's take a quick intermission. Brooke, do you remember what you were going to say? All right. Yeah.
You're not approaching it with the consciousness of the absence of the goat.
What do you mean?
Like, or the disappearance of the goat. You're actually just completely and totally present in the moment that it requires.
Yeah, right.
And so perhaps if you brought the same presence to a drinking latte, so you weren't drinking it as if it were disappearing.
Yeah.
You were just drinking it, or you weren't eating the cookie like as if the next bite. Like, as if you were on your way to the next bite while you're eating the current
one,
then you wouldn't be, like, I heard someone say once, hi, my name is so-and-so, and I think it's a more.
Yeah.
So, like, if you didn't have the more dynamic, then you just had, were totally, completely present with the chai, maybe the chai could be the gift that kept on giving, like.
Which gets us kind of back to the hugging saint, right? Because in a sense, she is... Here's the thing about the goat. Is the thing that really struck me a few days later, it was absolutely effortless. It took absolutely no effort. No, not even physical effort, you know? And absolutely no psychological effort. No mental effort. It wasn't like, oh, not now. It's such a bad time to save a goat. You know? They'll ruin our whole day of paddling. You know, it was just like... None of our minds went there. It was just... totally spontaneous, effortless.
Well, there's also, it's something, when you went to do that, it was a completely selfless act. There was no, like, it was a spontaneous and self, you actually had to, like, stop your fun, whatever that was, to be of service. And in that service, there's a sense of gratitude that rests in the heart.
Yeah.
In any, I think in any truly selfless service act, there's no sense of self.
Yeah.
You don't always have opportunities to act like that.
Well, and here's an interesting thing, right? I was talking about the goat in Prague recently, and this guy, the translator, he said something, and the translator said to me, like, I'm waiting, like, what's it going to be? And I was talking about the goat story, and he's like, yeah, but I never run across goats, you know? And it never even occurred to me. Like, I was like, yeah. That's such a dumb example. Like, who runs across goats, you know? Like, in a sense, we want that. But then I started thinking. I had an experience about a year ago where I very consciously, and this rarely happens, and even less so now, but I'm mostly obsessed with myself. But I had a moment where I thought, I'm going to go to work early, just in case anybody needs my help. It was really just this random feeling of, like, just of wanting to be of service, right? And so I went to work early, and because I was, you know, because normally I'm rushing. And I was thinking, like, it's just such a bad habit to always be rushing places, you know. I can't be present with people, and it's just like I want to get myself out of that modality. So I'm like, I'm going to go a full half hour early, you know, and just endure the anxiety of being at work early. So because I was early, I went and got gas. And I saw a grown, perfectly normal-looking guy sitting in his car crying. You know, and normally I wouldn't say anything because it's nerve-wracking to spark an intimacy with a stranger, right? But I just had something in me, and I said, like, what's going on, you know? Like, I looked in his car, and I said something like, what's going on? Why are you crying, you know? He's like, oh, I'm fine, you know? I said, you don't look fine. He said, it eventually came out he was out of gas. And it just, like, his whole day, it seemed like his... life was falling apart, and you know, it's just the final straw that broke him. You just, like, I remember one time I broke an egg and I just couldn't handle it. It, like, flipped me out. But you know, it's just the final thing, and he's just sitting there crying. I'm like, well, what are you gonna do? He's like, I don't know. I got a brother-in-law in Green Valley. Maybe I'll call him and he'll come bring me money. I was like, I'll put gas in your tank. And you know, it's just this, and it was a similar goat experience. I wasn't helping the guy, you know, out of the mud or anything, metaphorically a little bit, but it's that same feeling. So I wonder if somehow my intention to be of service in the world will bring people into your life that need you. And that's a fascinating idea. It's just the more that you can open your heart to the possibility that you can actually be of service, it's possible that the more goats will show up in your life.
Are we saying that that by saving more goats and whatever, that somehow, I mean, my dilemma right now is that we still feel the pain of the withdrawal
from
whatever our drug or relationship is.
Yeah.
And so while on one hand service can bring you more openness, like I know that when I drink a latte, I can't trick my mind into thinking that I'll only drink it that once.
Yeah, right.
But you're practicing wisdom by consciously thinking about it. Like, even if it's just like opening the door for somebody or saying, how are you today, or good morning, you're setting up the good karma and the practices that will eventually allow you to overcome bigger obstacles. I mean, I think.
And here's something. It's something you touched on earlier, and it's kind of one of the cruxes of this, is Shantideva, great Tibetan master, he says, wisdom and mindfulness utterly eradicates afflicted states. How would that look for our real life situation? It would look like the way that they're applying mindfulness to psychotherapy, right? This woman came into a therapist with a shoplifting addiction, right? And the therapist said, I don't want you to stop shoplifting. I just want you to notice what's happening in your body as you're shoplifting. I just want you to go in there and I want you to... Because what happens? Notice the next time you engage in addictive behavior. The mind kind of shuts down, right? Because you don't want to see it. So about 80% of your mind just shuts down and you kind of go on autopilot, It's like, oh yeah, I'll eat the chocolate cake, that's a better idea, then I'll be gone, autopilot, And most of my mind is like trying to like not realize what I'm doing, Until it's over. And it's a classic addictive behavior, right? And then it's over and you're like, what did I do, So the therapist said, just shoplift and notice physically what's happening in your body. Notice how is the heart rate increasing. Is your energy in your throat? Is it in your heart? Like, where energetically, where are you inhabiting your body most? At what point do you start to get shaky? Is it right when you enter the store, or is it when you see the object that you want? And what Shantideva, in essence, is proposing is that if we get more and more skillful at doing that, we are shortening the gap. Because what is the outcome of that kind of therapy? It's that eventually she no longer has the thirst to shoplift. She no longer has a desire to shoplift because the illusion that shoplifting is bringing her happiness has been shattered. So it's a matter of shattering the illusion of the things that we think are bringing us happiness. Now, and maybe we don't have much time. Maybe it will end with stuff I had heard Eve Emsler talk about. Just beautiful. So here's this woman. Those of you that don't know, she started talking to women about their genitalia, and she started becoming very aware of the amount of sexual trauma that women go through. And the UN came out with an unbelievable statistic that one out of every three women on the planet will be sexually violated in their life. Unbelievable statistic, So Eve started to make her whole life about this, about educating people about this, about, just bringing the taboo subjects out into the open. And in this talk I heard this morning, she started listing, which I won't do here, all of the things that she, the most horrendous things she came across, Like nations where women are just disappear, Thousands of women just disappear, unheard of it, and... Juarez, Mexico, and just all of the one thing after another. And she said, the more I started engaging in this, the more pleasurable my life became. That's an interesting, that's interesting. Because it seems like my problem is that the more I see the suffering in the world, the more I kind of shut down. Because I don't have the skills to deal with it, so I kind of close it off. And she said, she said, being in the face of things, seeing what is really in front of us, is the antidote to depression, anxiety, unhappiness, and a feeling of being worthless. Interesting, right? Just, and she said this over and over, just simply seeing what is in front of you. And then she said, before that happened, I realized that 80% of my consciousness was closed off to what was really going on. And when I heard her say that, I realized that there, I'm in that thing, you know? I'm in that 80% is shut off. And then she says, what happens when you open that part of you up is that your vitality and your life energy come back. Now, an example of what that would look like, and many of you know this story, is my first job out of getting my degree in psychology was to inform families or people that needed to know that a case was being built up against them for child molestation, which is a weird thing to have to tell people, right? And my very first time I went off, it was in northern Arizona, and it was out of town a little bit, and kind of a slightly scary house with a lot of dogs and pickup trucks on cinder blocks and stuff. And the father had been molesting the stepson, and we now had evidence for that, and so we had to go let him know that the stepson would be taken away and be part of the state, and that a case was going to be... So I was terrified, right? So I knock on the door, and the guy comes to the door. I said, "Are you so-and-so?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "I'm with this organization." And he said, "Well, let's step out back." And I'm like, "Oh, God." You know? I'm just like, you know, my first job out of school, and I'm get killed. what a career. And so I go talk to him, and I say, "What happened?" And his whole face shifted. And the minute I said what I was there for, his whole face became completely relieved. Right? The weirdest thing, the last expression I was expecting to see. And it's totally in line with what I heard Eve talk about this morning. Because the amount of energy it takes to withhold a lie, to withhold an untruth, even if it's just an untruth to ourselves, you know, much less a broader untruth which keeps other people involved. The amount of energy it takes to hold that sucks out our life energy, right? It sucks out all of our vitality. It makes us impossible for us to engage in pleasurable activity because 80% of ourselves isn't even there. And Eve said as she listened to more and more stories, but it wasn't just listening. She was actually, you know, she had the gift of knowing how to act in the world. Right? And when I think about, like, leading a life of service, because, you know, we talked about, we all do have numerous opportunities every day to serve people. Why don't we? I mean, maybe you do. I'm just speaking generally. Why don't we spend our whole day serving people, you know? And for me, it's this feeling of, like, it makes me nervous to think about serving other people. Because I think it makes me nervous to renounce things, to renounce my own happiness for the happiness of others. That makes me nervous. When somebody says, "Hey, will you do me a favor?" Right? The first thought that comes into my mind is like, "Oh no, what?" You know? It's like the very first thing. It's not like, "Yes, because this will make me happy." Right? It's this first thought, right? But Eve kind of got sucked into this. She got so moved by the trauma. And then realized that by creating the vagina monologues and bringing this out, she was also seeing all the healing. So she became part of a dynamic life force that was foundationally about serving other people. And I think, Brooke, this gets back to your thing. Is it possible to make love with your partner and have that act in and of itself be also about serving other people? And I think if you can find that clue... then you are locked into a passionate spiritual life. And when you see Eve, when you see many spiritual masters, they are so full of life. You know, they're so full of possibility. They're so full of vitality. And they're also so acutely aware of the intensity of the suffering of the world. So acutely aware. You know, where I'm so generally aware. Because so much of myself is shut off from feeling that. So I think maybe that's a good time to end. And if anybody has any questions or comments or anything to add. Or...
I have a question. It seems like the wolf, getting back to the goat,
yeah.
is goat and the latte both bring pleasure.
Yeah.
It seems like they're fundamentally different in the nature, in their natures. And so do you think we need, it's important to distinguish that and how, and like what maybe healthier forms of pleasure are?
Yeah, and I think it kind of gets back to what Shad was saying, what creates a lasting thing. But to me, the fundamental difference is that the real pleasure always has a taste of serving other people, serving other beings. And to me, that's the fundamental thing. But the interesting thing is it possible to engage in seemingly selfish behavior, like getting a chai latte, in a way where it's also about serving other beings? And I would say, and the Buddhist path in general says yes, that you can. But and here's where you get so very subtle. And here's why it's so important to have a teacher. Because I can delude myself in thinking that drinking chai, you know, may I drink it for all sentient beings. Or, you know, it's so possible to just live in a deluded state about that, you know. But I think it is possible. And I feel like I've been around masters that are able to do this. That with every sip and with every bite, they're thinking about other beings. I think it can go a lot deeper. I think it's interesting homework, you know, to like engage in sex and try to figure out how could this possibly, even masturbation, you can think about how could this possibly be about serving other people. It's interesting. It's an interesting dilemma. But and the more you get into the deeper teachings of yoga, the more you realize that the more we can get prana into the central channel, the more powerful a being we can become. So that might have something to do with it. But I think it's possible. Because I think I used to cook for a great, great master named Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And he never ate a hot meal I made. Ever. Because I would put the meal in front of him, you know. And then he would pray for all the beings that were killed in making the meal. For all the migrant workers that harvested, you know, he would dissect whatever I made. Say it was a lasagna, right? In his mind, he was dissecting every part of that lasagna. He was seeing the tomatoes, right? He was seeing the wheat, the grinding of the wheat. Who ground the wheat? How did that wheat get to this? You know, who made the food? And he was just, as he was eating it, he was thinking to himself, may this food nourish my soul in a way that I can give back to all these people for their labor and their lives. And I saw this, and if I hadn't seen it to the intensity that he actually did it, with every single meal, I would think it was impossible. And that's the kind of... But he was such a naturally joyful person. His attendant told me he's never eaten a meal on the plane. Because by the time the plane needs to land, and they're like, you know, he's still like, oh my boy, oh my boy. But I think there's a clue in that. Somehow, if we can make our lives about serving other people, genuinely, not through kind of a spiritual, materialistic, deluded state, but generally opening our heart more and more and more to suffering, I think it's possible to engage in, to also increase our pleasure, even with something like a bite of food. Because imagine doing that with a lasagna. Imagine taking that bite, you know, you're really tasting it. You're really feeling it. Like, we just, Mir and I just went to a friend's farm and we had pizza, but we ground the wheat ourselves. The cheese was made from the cows that we milked that morning, you know. We're so in touch with all the food. And I bit into it and the pizza was like unbelievable, you know. But mostly how I eat pizza is like, having a lot of male friends as a child, you have to get as much in your mouth as possible because, you know, there's only a limited amount of pizza. So it's just like, oh, rah, 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 you know, to make sure you get filled. So it's like such two different ways of engaging in food, you know. And one is inherently more pleasurable. So I think it has to do with all this and with that idea of engaging with activities mindfully. And I think the last thing I want to say is the important thing about that is it takes guilt out of the equation. Because when you're engaging in addictive behavior, like you said with sex, the motivation is a good one, right? If, say, you have sex addiction issues, the motivation is because whenever time you have orgasm, you're having all that prana run through the central channel. When you have prana run through the central channel, that is a feeling of homecoming. It's a feeling of where we're meant to live, but yet we're doing it in a deluded way. So you remove guilt from the equation and you just observe how you're acting. Is this actually working? And then as soon as guilt comes out of the equation, for me, the blinders open up and I can just simply watch, like the woman shoplifting, you know. It's, you can just watch. Oh, interesting. Now I feel shaky in my hands, you know. Oh, now my heart rate has increased. There's not like, I'm such a bad person, I shoplift, I'm stupid, you know. It's not like, oh, it's so bad. Because then the mind, the blinders are going to quickly come down. So I know that's a ridiculous amount of information and thoughts and ideas. Hopefully you're not more agitated than when you came in here or anything like that. But let's end there, I think. And I'll be around if anybody has any comments or anything they want to talk about. Thank you all so much for coming, for taking your time out of your Friday night to come to a talk on suffering and pleasure.